Welcome to Dugout Study Hall, a remedial course in baseball stats and proud member of the Pitcherless Podcast Network. I'm your host and expert layman, Matt Goodwin, and I am joined, as always, by your fake baseball economist, Alexander Chase. On this episode, we dive into our respective TGFBI results by slicing the draft into thirds, picks 1 through 10, 11 through 20, and 21 through 30. We squeeze in a little discussion about formats at the end, too, and a note for listeners. We record these episodes days before they come out. In this case, it was recorded on Wednesday night, so bear with some of the mentions of there being no deal yet. It was true at the time. And so, without further ado, Alexander, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing pretty well. How are you doing this week, Matt?
Doing pretty well. Not going to complain too much. I suppose I could, but I won't. I will spare the listeners my whining and complaining about things that are beyond all of our control. We did wrap up. I mean, I wrapped up. I don't know when you finished. Did you finish your TGFBI draft this week, or was it like one of those super fast ones that went like real quick?
We are recording Wednesday. I finished today. I got my last pick in this morning. I feel like it really dragged towards the end. We definitely slowed down a bit.
Yeah, I on one hand, it's kind of like, all right, we're at the end. But at the same time, it's like, well, but we're at the end. You know, like there's, you want to make the smart pick there at the end of your draft as well. We're going to talk about all that sort of stuff. I want to start by talking about something that's maybe a little bit more of a serious tone than we generally take at the beginning of our episodes, but I want to get your take on what it's like for you as a baseball fan, as a podcaster, as an industry writer, to talk about baseball during this lockout. Like, I don't know. I feel like some people are kind of ostriching, like it's going to be fine. We're going to get it soon. Everything's going to be okay. There are like the doomsdayers who are like, oh, we're not getting baseball at all this year. And then I feel like there's a whole bunch of people kind of in the middle, as it usually works out to be, right? In a bell curve of things. I'm very interested. How do you kind of land in that kind of spectrum of processing this idea of baseball being locked out?
So I think one of the big things that kind of changes how I process things is that like my idea of what I am as like a writer and stuff like that isn't like hyper-focused on the idea of I'm going to produce content that helps you to rank players and draft them. And there are a lot of people who like do that all of the time, are good at it, and it's their job. And that is really stressful for them. And I want to make sure I don't like come in off the bat like people who just do rankings are like bad, because that's stupid. And like not reflective of the reality. Like I care about the people who are stressed out about their job essentially being put on hold. FanGraphs is gonna struggle. People like Prospect Live, who like are run as basically a Patreon, is like one of their big income sources. If people start canceling that because there's like nothing to care about, like that hurts them, right? Pitcherlist had like survives in part because people like sign up for the Discord, and like that's still fun, but like without baseball, fewer people get paid to do baseball content. And I want to just make sure I say off the top, like, there are a lot of people who have that as their actual job, and they super depend on it. I'm happy that I don't have to worry about that, and this is just, like, a thing that pays for my NFBC drafts, or, like, microphones, or, like, beer, and that's basically all it, like, is relied upon for. So that is kind of, like, the first thing that comes to mind. But because that is not the person who I am, right? This is all kind of just for fun. And my focus is pretty explicitly on baseball as a whole, and then fantasy is just a fun way to kind of get into it, and also like explore some other things I'm interested in, like, you know, economics nonsense. I really, really enjoy this stuff in the same way that I enjoy talking about baseball. I think it's important to be able to engage with reality, and, you know, like, baseball is just reality with in a funhouse mirror. I think you have to care about this stuff, and being able to go in off the deep end and talk about a bunch of complicated and really greatly important and rather reflective of other parts of our reality sort of stuff is like good. I don't hate doing it. I don't like want to log on and argue with people, but like loathe it in some sort of like I don't want to upset certain people sort of way.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've discovered, and you know, I think I was maybe one of the people who was doing a little bit of that ostriching, where it was like, it's coming, it's fine. If there's a little bit of a delay, it's okay. Again, I don't mean to be insensitive to people whose incomes are dependent upon. I think that's an excellent point. I am very fortunate that that is not the case for me. So I guess it's easy for me to be a little bit more laissez-faire about that element of it. So, and I don't want it to come off as though I'm trivializing that. I'm sure that that is incredibly stressful for all of these people whose income source is kind of generated around the game itself. I've been having a hard time as of late trying to, get excited about continuing to talk about this thing that's making me sad. You know, I want to write an article. I want to come up with an idea. I want to get ready to go and set up the section that I kind of co-run with Ben Brown on Pitcher List, our We Love Baseball section. And it's kind of like this thing where it's, I forget who I was talking to, but at some point somebody said, like, it's hard to love something that doesn't love you back. And it's right now, it kind of feels like baseball's not loving us back. And maybe that's just me and the way that I'm wired, and that's fine. I'm sure I'm not alone in all of that. But you know, I want to be excited about these things. And then, you know, I sit down and like, what are we going to talk about on the podcast? Okay, well, we're starting to say a lot of the same things over and over again, because that's what there is to discuss and talk about. So we're trying really hard not to be overly redundant, but there's a lot of people out there starving to try and create content. It's a saturated space. That's a good thing. There's a lot of really smart things being written and said and done. But without the game moving forward at its regular pace and being able to transition from off-season content to preseason content to in-season content, we're just kind of in this, like, what's that place that you go when you don't go to heaven or hell? What's it called? Purgatory, right? We're in this like baseball purgatory right now. I don't know. It's feeling like a little bit of a bummer. I don't want to be like I'm going to bring people down here at the top of the episode. I just was very curious as to the kind of the approach that you were taking. I know that like you were talking about your economic side, you always sort of seem to have this like view on things that I don't. And I find it really valuable to hear your takes on those things, because I'm thinking of it from a completely different lens, I guess. But I do know how great it's going to feel when we finally get that notification that the CBA has been worked out and it is coming back. And then we'll obviously have more things to talk about as they start playing spring training games, and we can talk about actual on-field performance and where in the lineup has this person been. Mike Kurland has said that he's going to do kind of that spring training deep dive stuff that he did last year again this year. So there'll be so much more to talk about. It'll be so energizing and nice to see. It's I don't know. It feels kind of like the dark ages right now in terms of trying to figure out what it is that we want to discuss and talk about. So thank you for sharing your thoughts on that, Alexander. I kind of put you on the spot with that. I know I did. But we can talk about some drafts, and I think that that's where we're going to focus. There's been a lot of industry drafting going on. You and I have participated, as we've mentioned before, both in RazSlam and TGFBI, so we'll get a chance to talk a little bit about that. There's other expert leagues that are drafting as well, way above my pay grade, so to speak, the touts and the labors of the world. So there's things we can discuss there in different formats. And there's a lot of like, let's talk about the infrastructure of fantasy that we can get into. And I think it's going to be a fun and exciting episode. I'm so sad that baseball is not part of the discussion of baseball. It just seems so weird and so off. Go ahead.
Yeah. That also kind of like has some really funny, but like not funny ricochet effects on like all of these industry drafts as well.
Yeah.
I often like say that like the reason that I care about things like Hall of Fame voting and stuff like that is it kind of like forces people who talk about things to like reveal who they are. And in a much less serious way, we're getting some stuff that's mildly similar from like the content machine people, like in a good way, like people who like do all these industry drafts have good ideas and get to think about things, because suddenly they're putting on the spot. And like when I say machine, I mean it in a good way. Some people are just drafting and writing stuff, like creating podcasts, like every single day they get a new chance to like try out their priors.
Yeah, and, right.
You know, like that means that there's constantly someone who's like, oh, I had been working this way, and then suddenly I realized I'm not drafting free agent outfielders who haven't landed, and I realize everyone else isn't doing that, and I went and looked and think these guys might be a whatever the take may be.
Yeah, try and find the market inefficiency that arises out of the situation itself.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to see how a lot of people are kind of digesting putting that all together. So, like, there is always a cheap silver lining that's not really actually silver that you can find around these sorts of things. And that's been, like, the one that I have pointed to recently for myself.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it instead of my Debbie Downer outlook on things. Let's talk a little bit about our RazSlam and TGFBI teams. I don't want to do like a round by round. There's a lot of people out there putting out that content. That's just not our wheelhouse. It's not that it's not good content. It's just not what we do. But maybe we could look at it in terms of slices. So I'm going to ask you where you want to go first with that, and then I'll follow the leader.
Yeah, so one of the funny things about like having this on my phone over the past couple of weeks is that if you have your digital draft board on mobile, is it slices it up into picks of five and then repeats the team names. And it's forced my brain to think about the draft into like pieces of five and 10. So what I wanted to do is kind of talk about for each of the first and then middle and then last 10 rounds with TGFBI, some of like the picks that we like really were excited and things that we maybe hit on, a couple of like the forced or unforced misses around, and then also just some bigger takeaways. I definitely felt like the depth of this and also kind of like the stress at the top because of the pseudo competitiveness of this really made me evaluate things constantly in like a, am I doing this right? Where are my priors a little bit weird? And am I enjoying this? And so I feel like taking like a big view like that rather than just like talking about the guys at the top that everyone's always going to talk about is kind of nice. That's one of the nice things about 15 team leagues, actually, is that you don't get that many of those guys at the top. So you actually do have to think about a lot of other people in the process.
Yeah, most definitely. It definitely felt different with the 15 teams rather than the 12, especially coming off the RazSlam. And something else we can talk about later on, a best ball kind of format versus a weekly lineup setup. RazSlam is two FOB periods for the whole season, whereas TGFBI is weekly. So very different elements there. One is points. The other one is roto. So many different things going on and formats that we can kind of touch on there. But do you want to just start with the first 10 of your TGFBI and where you kind of saw some like thing, some value that you really like that you did, something you'd like that you did, something that maybe you would do differently if you had it to remap out. You can pick. Choose your own adventure today, Alexander.
So I feel like I didn't have as many complaints for myself in the first 10 rounds. I mean, there are some things that I wish I had been luckier about that maybe would have changed some choices that I would have made. But all told, I didn't feel like I did something that I deeply regret through the first 10 rounds. And there are some places later on where I don't know if I have some deep regrets. I have one that is really minor, very late, and it's kind of stupid. but yeah, I felt like I got really lucky a lot of times. And I think we said this last time, I don't know how I ended up with Gerrit Cole with the number 12 pick. Like, that's just stuff that happens because the people around you are doing stuff you disagree with. And I had a whole lot of that. And I didn't expect to have a whole lot of that. So, I mean, it showed up later, for sure. But, like, if I want to pick out a guy that I feel like I'm really, really happy with, it is Max Muncy. I'm always the person that is going to be slightly higher on one or two injury risk-y guys because I just don't think that we crunch the numbers on that properly. And then came out this week. Said that his elbow's basically fine. He's felt like he'd be on track for opening day, and the ongoing risk that opening day may be a little bit later seems like it's helping him
right.
more.
Benefit. Yeah.
Yeah. So
where did you get him?
I got him in the 9th round.
Okay.
I'm sure to tell you
where I got him?
Yes, I do.
I got him at pick 163 in the 11th round.
God. So, okay. So you got him where I got Ahmed Rosario. Oh my God. God, that's what we better value. So, yeah, I feel like that's a guy that shows up on a lot of my teams, or a guy like him will show up on a lot of my teams.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So I wanted to say, like, that's the sort of like procedural I feel like I had set myself up for him to not be a miss. And that's really what I wanted to say about this, more than just like, haha, I was right, y'all were wrong.
I managed
to pick him up after picking up Brandon Lau. And later on, I was able to get Luke Voit, who's another first baseman that I feel like if he's playing, and I feel like he's going to be playing, I can trust. So I managed to build myself a situation where Max Muncy is almost my like MICI flex option in terms of my team building, even though he's way better than that. And that was the thing that I was really happy about for this draft as a whole, is that thinking about depth and how to not just screw yourself, I felt like I was able to execute a plan to not get boxed in. I don't know if I'm going to call this as much a miss, but I never like it. So the guy that I'm a little bit less good about is Giovanni Gallegos, just because I hate closers. And I got him with my first closer in the 7th round, about pick 100. That should be good value. I just never like closers. And yeah, I'm scared that St. Louis is going to do something stupid at all times. So yeah, that's kind of like my first slice. Guys, who do you want to kind of take a closer look at among your first 10 picks?
Well, I have two things that I want to talk about, and I actually would like your feedback on rather than mine. I took three people in my first 10 picks that I normally would not. I took two catchers and a closer in my first 10. Not something that I would ever normally do, but I think the format pushed. Well, first of all, closers have been pushed up enormously. So I took one that I am not confident in. I don't like the pick personally, but it was the right paper pick. I don't know if that makes sense. It was like, it was very much a brain versus heart kind of thing. And so I wound up with Salvador Perez in the 3rd, nice. Something I would never normally do. I backed him up with Varsho in the 6th round. Partially because I kept missing on steals too, so he kind of helped me with a little bit of a, he's obviously not stealing 40 bases, but it gives me a little bit, plus it's catcher in a two catcher league where the catcher gets thin real quick. So I thought that those were picks that, to my mind, were really good value compared to what other teams in the league are going to have in that spot. And I took, I don't want to say it out loud. I took Chapman in the 5th. It's just so hard, because once you get past a certain number of those closers, it's really kind of like a dart throw for a number of reasons. Either there's competition or the team might do some weird things. And I feel like Chapman is solidly in the role, but could very easily not be, because they're a team that's not going to tolerate his craziness and like inconsistency that happens. If he's not great right away, they have a bunch of other people who could take over that role really easily. He's got a history of kind of being injured or going through stretches of not being amazing. So I held my nose and did that one because it was the right pick at the time. It absolutely was. It's not my favorite pick. So very unusual for me to do two catchers and a closer within my first 10 picks, especially in such a competitive league. But I think in the end it worked out. We'll see how it goes. What are your thoughts on what I did there?
Getting two catchers in your first 10 picks is undoubtedly the smart move. I wish that I had been a little bit smarter and not ended up with the second catcher that I have. We'll get there. We'll get there for sure. You know how people say that they like to punt catcher as a way to express that they don't know what they're doing in two catcher leagues? I may have soft punted my second catcher a little bit. And the good news is I can rely on someone else to probably make a bad move and drop someone who's rather decent for some reason. And, you know, I'll read the room, but I definitely think it's smart to have two good options. Jordan Rosenblum got Perez and Smith back to back. I talked about that last week. I have Real Muto also because of the steals at catcher. I know I don't draft steals. I like Real Muto. So like you doing the same sort of thing, I'm always here for. The thing about Chapman is, and I want to give credit to Dan Szymborski as the person who most often points this out, you can always hedge playing time a little bit by looking at how much money people are going to make. It's the reason Eric Hosmer is going to play a lot more than he probably should this year. And it's the reason why Chapman is going to close more games than he probably should this year. Ditto Will Smith probably, and a few other people. So like, I don't love him, but the chance that he gets yanked out of that role is a little bit lower
permanently
than I think it probably should be.
I think you're right, but I do see them saying for the next few weeks we're gonna either, you know, IL him, or we're going to have him come in different situations or things like that. So I don't know, it's shakier than I would want with an investment that early in the position, but it's a position that dries up real fast. So, and I think I did a nice job of coming back on the back end. Since I took him there, I kind of didn't pay much attention to that for a while, and still kind of came through with some decent options later, which we'll get to. So it feels like that was an Alexander stamp of approval on what I did there.
I don't love it, but I get it. And that's kind of like my
point. I mean, overall, in terms of like the, you know, the two catcher approach, and very anti what I would normally do. So you want to look now at 11 through 20?
As a bridge there, I think the thing I want to say is kind of like a broader takeaway for how I felt through 10 picks is I was like, oh, we're into this draft, like 10 rounds, 150 picks, right? After 150 picks, you know, if you're used to playing 10s or even 12s, right, you're going to have a lot of your team filled out, right?
Yes.
I started out playing a lot of 10 team leagues because that's what a lot of casual people do, I feel like. And there have been a lot of leagues where it's like, you know, got like pretty much most of your team set, got like almost your entire starting lineup, and like it is
it got
different.
Late early in these drafts.
And I mean, I've been mentally working my way to that adjustment for a while, but like through 10 rounds I didn't have a shortstop, and I feel like a lot of people have to not have a shortstop through 10 rounds. It's just statistically going to happen, right? I felt like I was the only one, and looking around, like there were actually like four other teams that didn't. I want to shout out team one of my league for taking both Tatis and Wander Franco again. Like, congrats, guy, for really exacerbating the problem. I feel like I see a lot of people's teams who are like, yeah, I double tapped Bichette and Lindor or whatever. I'm like, why did you do that? Why did you want to do that? So that is
maybe, I mean, listen, not just positing this, you tell me if you think it's nuts, but is it like, if I'm hoarding the resource, then other people don't have it? It's still valuable at my middle infielder, but it's taking that away from somebody else's ability.
I don't think people actively do that. I think it's just like shortstops are good. They play all the time. They're bets to not get platooned. Sure. There's a reason you want them. Simultaneously, though, that was my reasoning for not taking them early. Is it's like, oh yeah, if I can get a shortstop late, those people are good defensively. They don't get platooned. So I just go get a guy in the 10th or 12th round or so. He's going to play all the time, and that's a safer playing time pick than some of the other guys in that range. That was, if I'm kind of bridging into this area, a thing that was an active consideration once we left the top area. I'm someone who really, really likes to think about how playing time projections are wrong on like the 140 versus 150 game basis, but I deeply care about making sure I get people in drafts like these where there is no ability to kind of like make the daily moves, who are going to play every day so long as they're healthy. And like a little bit of rest here and there isn't going to hurt. If you're playing six games a week, regardless of whether or not there are seven on the schedule, cool. If you get rested for like a really bad platoon once and it turns into a five game week for you, still cool. Like, I'm just worried about situations where someone is going to like have like a three game week. I want to avoid those as hard as I could. So,
and you're not going to be able to anticipate it or have somebody to fill in for them. Yeah.
Right. So for the 11 through 20 range, this is picks from 151 to 300. This was a place where my top priorities were finding depth, flexibility, and not stepping on the platoon landmine. I also needed bags real bad because I don't like them. So
it was such a thing.
So the guy that I didn't initially like that I warmed up to quite a bit was Josh Rojas. I got him in the 16th round. And like, you know, that's like, we're getting into halfway done. He's going to be eligible for second base, shortstop, and outfield this year. So I feel like that really helped me out in some different ways. Importantly also for him is that he's going to be leading off for Arizona most games. That's going to be good. So he's I think like a 15-15, give him 90 runs, give him like 60 RBI sort of guy, maybe. That's a good case. I would take that for sure at that spot. The reason, though, that I ended up taking him is because I kind of screwed up a couple times on the turn in some ways, and I ended up with Ahmed Rosario as my starting shortstop. I thought that I couldn't get O'Neill Cruz, and I just needed to grab someone. I'm not a big Ahmed Rosario fan, so I got him. I don't feel great about it, but he is going to steal, and that's basically why I took him. So there was kind of like a push-pull of like my choices in there, and maybe Rosario ends up working out just fine. I don't think I'm going to drop him or anything at any point. I mean, chances are he plays through the year. Cleveland's going to need him to, but like that was definitely my thought, is that I wanted to make sure I didn't do anything tremendously stupid through these rounds. Pick a guy who just won't play.
Yeah.
And
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's you're 100% right. When you start looking at, you know, you're looking at your 11th pick and the well has gone seemingly dry. I guess people who do these more probably are way more used to it. It doesn't feel that way for them, but it definitely did for me. Like I said, I got Max Muncy in the 11th round. I felt like that was awesome. I was very excited about that. And then I was really trying to, chase as much value in the places that I felt like I needed it as possible in these middle rounds without going nuts, without reaching too far. There were people that I wanted that I could have reached for. O'Neill Cruz, I would have liked to have gotten. I would have had to have reached. And I just wasn't willing to do that just because I didn't feel like it was the place to do that. So I got Ian Anderson in round 12. I liked that to go with some of my other pitchers. I started off with Scherzer in my first 10, so that was nice. I was able to get Clayton Kershaw in the 14th. I thought that was crazy value. So that was pick 198. And I got a couple more closers here in this area. I got Dylan Floro. Is it Floro? Am I saying that right, Alexander?
I think so.
Dylan Floro. That's what it looks like. I'm sorry, Dylan, if I'm mispronouncing your name. And then Andrew Kittredge in the 17th. So that was where I was able to kind of make up those saves after I got Chapman. I'm pretty happy with where that landed. Also, again, this is weekly FOB. So if I'm willing to extend myself a little bit and chase some saves on the wire, which always become available, I think I'll be okay there. But I was definitely desperate for bags. And in my 16th round, I took Raimel Tapia because I kind of felt like I needed to. It was very similar to, I think, to what you were doing there, except your guy has more positional flexibility. So you probably wind up with a little bit of a better situation there. I also was able to get Paul Sewald from Seattle there in the 19th. I know he's not guaranteed to have the job, but I kind of felt like he's a good arm. He's probably the better between him and Giles. Giles might get the nod, as you said before, maybe he's because he's making more money, maybe because he's got the name recognition, but I really feel like it's not going to be long before there are save opportunities there for him. So that's kind of where I went there. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, I feel like really, really tough to just like get through that. Feel like you've been covering all of the bases that you need to cover and like not hate yourself. And
yeah.
Like, did you feel like through 20 rounds, like you had like a team that was doing all the things that you needed it to?
Except for steals. I actually did feel pretty good about where I was going with all of this stuff. There were a lot of guys that I was like hemming and hawing at the turn. So just a reminder, I was picking at 13. So, you know, I would pick and then four people would come off the board. I'd pick again. And then like whatever it is, 20 something people would come off the board. And it was very hard. I would hem and haw a lot. I'm happy with what I got, but I know that I lost a lot of players that I wanted. Because I made a tough call in a moment and there was just no way that 26 picks later they were going to be there. So I think I felt disheartened is probably not the right word, but for the players that I wanted that I didn't get, then I feel bad about who I wound up with. I don't know if that makes sense, but
how frequently did you feel like you got sniped by like your turn mates?
Well, one of my turn mates was Eno Saris, so a bunch of times. you know, it's, I think I actually tweeted this. It, one thing about being sniped by Eno is at least it makes you feel like you are thinking the right way. it's validating in that way and frustrating in another, but, you know, I felt like more that, I was like, oh, this guy might make it back to me. I got my hopes up, and then it wasn't really a snipe because it was maybe like six or seven picks before I even had a chance. But like a bunch of them had happened, you know, like 13 people had come off the board, and I was like, oh, maybe nope. Nope, that's gone. And there were these runs too, where it was like, okay, I can survive until the next round until for this position or for this category. And then like all the steals guys that I was eyeing went within one kind of turn or something like that. So I think I was feeling the opportunity cost more than I was feeling bad about what I wound up with. I don't know how those two things can happen at the same time, but I guess that's kind of where I was at.
I feel like the big takeaway I had like at every moment is like, I just basically decided that outfielder was a thing I was only going to take if I really hated all my other options. And like, I just filled it last along the way for the most part.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah. And as a result, like I would have like basically an A plan and a B plan and then an outfield plan at all times. So I basically just never allowed myself to think I was getting sniped on outfield. And as a result, I would watch and I'd have like, for example, 17th round. I wanted to get my second catcher and there was a five catcher long run before my turn. Darno, Sanchez, Narvaez, Haas, and Kelly all went in the five consecutive picks before I went.
So I said,
I'm going to kick it down the road again. And
sure.
So I got Luke Voit there. And there were a couple catchers taken in the next like 30 something picks, but no one I wanted. And I ended up getting Max Stassi. And he'll play most of the time ish, you know, like have a pretty large side of the platoon and for the Angels, and he'll be somewhere in their lineup, I guess. And that's about as good as I felt like I could do. He's probably a 20th or so best catcher sort of guy, and that's not the 24th. Maybe he's 15th. Who knows? It's not a big difference at that point. And that's what the catcher people all say is like the gap between the middle bottom and the actual bottom is all trivial. So why go first? In this case, like I would have been really happy to get Darno. I guess I didn't. But like I got Voit as a result of that. I feel like I got Bailey Ober on my turn mate, and I ended up getting Mark Canha there. So like that was when I actually took an outfielder. So I feel like that mid rounds is just like I'm not making any choices and I'm letting other people make choices for me. And where they go wrong, I would just try to capitalize every turn. And it really mattered that I wasn't boxing myself in and leaving myself with big holes to fill. And that was all I could go for.
Absolutely. That makes sense. I'd like to go through these last 10 picks. And because I think that this is one of those places where like the Cedric Mullins of last year is lives. Not that there is a Cedric Mullins for this year, but that's where he went if he was drafted. But before we get a chance to kind of debrief these last picks in our TGFBI rounds, we are going to take a very short break.
Hey, Alex Fast here, and thanks for listening to this podcast on the Pitcher List Podcast Network. If you're a fan, consider supporting all of us by getting a PL Plus subscription, where you're going to get an ad-free website and get access to our Discord, where you can talk to all of our podcast hosts and staff. Plus, you can hang out with our incredible Pitcher List community. It's basically a baseball sanctuary year-round for as low as $8 a month. You can sign up at pitcherlist.com/plus, and you're going to get your first month free with promo code podcast. Also, don't forget to check out everything else we do as well, from YouTube videos, live streams, newsletters, off-season articles, TikToks, breakdowns, over 15 baseball podcasts on our network. We can't stop talking about baseball even during the off-season. So sign up for PL Plus today at pitcherlist.com/plus and use promo code podcast to get your first month free. All right. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
And we're back. We're going to kind of go through the last 10 picks. TGFBI is a 30 person per team draft. I did not say that very eloquently, but I think you understand what it is that I'm getting at. So we're going to go through picks 21 through 30. Alexander, take it away.
So the theme of my last 10 picks was old. because I'm kidding. Mostly because my strategy is that I take the risks at the top. Mm-hmm. I take Buxton at the top, and then to replace Buxton if he gets hurt, I need to make sure that I'm not taking another shot at the bottom. And that is extremely reflected in my team composition. So I ended up with, and please laugh along the way as much as you need to, but I promise it was an execution of the plan. I ended up with both Andrew McCutchen and Lorenzo Cain on back-to-back picks at one point. I think Cain might actually be my essentially Buxton replacement. Point, yeah.
Especially if outfield is where you were
a little bit lighter. Then, yeah. I got Isaiah Kiner-Falefa as my like shortstop, third base backup. He'll play for a little while. Maybe Texas replaces him. Who cares? I'll dump him if I don't, sort of guy. It's like these were all my skills came from. I got both Diego Castillo and Colin McHugh as late closer flyers that I can dump. You know, Colin McHugh's unsigned and like was basically the best pitcher in the world. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but was really good last year.
And was like, is he unsigned? I thought he was with Tampa, or was that the end of last year?
He was with Tampa last year in that hybrid, like long, high leverage slash sometimes opener role that was just like really valuable for them. It would not shock me if a team picks him up to like have some sort of meaningful role that, and this is the idea here, I could start him like pretty frequently on this team as a wins and ratios benefit and strikeouts even to a degree like beneficial guy, like medium good strikeout rate. And like, would that be better or worse than starting a seventh starting pitcher who just isn't very good and could blow everything up? So
right,
you know, and what are the odds that maybe he gets signed somewhere to maybe be a closer? I don't think it happens, but like, you know, let's say that let's say he goes to Philly, right? And like a couple weeks in, he's suddenly Philly's closer. Cool.
Yeah, it's not crazy, you know. I definitely am a proponent of I would rather have a high leverage reliever, even if there's almost zero chance they're going to get a save, filling a spot than a real meh starter just because that person's a starter. I think that they could do more damage. You don't want the zero. You're not going to start an empty spot, but I'd rather have Aaron Bummer, I think, in there than I would, you know, some guy off the scrap heap who could totally blow up.
Let's be really rude here. Like, Miles Michaelis or Luke Weaver or some guys who went in the last couple of rounds. No offense to them. Matt Manning. One of the pieces of research,
those guys don't have upside, right? Yeah. There's not really a chance that they're going to be really, really good. I tried to get pitchers late that at least have upside, even if it's unlikely. The problem is I might have to hold on to them for a while to find out. That's where it becomes challenging. But
yeah, the way that I expressed that was pretty simple. In the 21st, I took Eric Lauer as a guy who I think is going to be a starter, and like I'm going to put him in. The defense is good. The opponents aren't always that good. He'll get some starts for me. He'll definitely start any two-start week for me for the first little while I have him. I don't think he's as great as maybe Nick has said he is, but I'm fine with him. And then I got like Nick Pivetta as like a, he'll strike some people out. He might have a job. And I don't think he's that terrible because I think he's found some more stuff in Boston than he had early on. Sort of guy. And like, that's when I stopped taking like current starters and kind of pivoted. You know, I got Tyler Beedy in the 29th. I'll drop him if he's
not. I actually kicked myself for not remembering to draft him.
Yeah. The guy I kicked myself for not drafting actually is Nick Lodolo. Rosenblum got him and I'm annoyed. I had the opportunity.
I got him in Raz. I didn't get him in TGFBI.
Yeah. I've been sniffing around a dynasty to trying to pick him up as well. Just like, cause really I was like, oh, actually like he's going to be up really quickly. And kind of digging into what he did in the minors and like his profile, I think he actually can survive pretty well in Cincinnati. We'll see. Well, I'm just trusting other people's opinions, but like he seems like the sort of guy who could definitely like be okay and have a high floor, which is probably a nice thing for a rookie. So anyways, but like, yeah, like all the guys I took here late, like Juan Yepes is like the only rookie on my roster. It's very much a, I did the research, making sure you fill in as many games played for hitters as possible is important. And for pitchers, what I found is that the gap between a zero and like a streaming starting pitcher is not very far. And in a lot of cases, if you've got a like wins or steals vultures and good ratios reliever, that might be better to start. So I think there's going to be a lot of weeks where I start six starters, two closers, and one middle reliever, essentially, with like the, you know, Diego Castillo is like that guy on my team right now because I think he actually might shake out, but I think I might drop him and pick up someone else in a similar position.
Well, you and you can get away with that sometimes because you get some sneaky wins in a quality starts league. You're not gonna get that, right? You'll never get a quality start from a middle reliever, but you can snag a win sometimes.
Yeah, definitely the thought. Good teams only, though, to be clear.
Yeah, definitely. Or are really good pitchers. You know, even if they're not on a great team, you're not going to get the sneaky win. But if they're going to go out there and they're going to, you know, I don't know if they're in four innings or three innings, they're going to get a handful of strikeouts a couple times a week. That's better than I still think that's better than a starter who could totally kill your ratios.
Yeah, I had like a whole list of those guys. And I ended up with McHugh, but Daniel Hudson for the the Dodgers, I felt like was another name. Like, he's got plenty of experience in like a long term. He's in his like mid late 30s, but his strikeout rate has stuck there. He's going to be in leverage. I think he'd be a guy that would work there. And Tim Mesa in Toronto had like a just disgusting strikeout rate, and the contact profile was good. And
even somebody like a Tyler Matzik though in Atlanta, you know,
so like, many of those sorts of guys.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
I picked up Matzik in my dynasty startup as like a, oh, actually, look, his walk rate went way down last year towards the end. Maybe he's good again, and I'll drop him 2 weeks in if he's not. Sort of guy.
So, yeah, but there's right. That's what you can do, you know. And he showed some promise, so I don't know. He can be very good. On my last 10, I kind of just went with. Who did I think was the best option at the spaces that I needed positions? I took a chance on Kevin Biggio. I know that there's a chance that he's just a guy, but he has been more than just a guy, whether that is just dumb luck or not. He is going to be in an amazing offense. So, you know, even if he's just getting on base and contributing runs, you know, that's something. It's something more than nothing in the 23rd round. Your guy from last year, Tyler Naquin, I know how much you loved him, grabbed him. I was able to get Zach Greinke in the 25th round. I think that's a high upside play.
I think there's a good chance he was kind of like tired, basically, just like a lot of other people were. Cause he ate so many innings last year. Like,
sure. But I mean, he's Zach Greinke, you know, like the people that were going around him just don't have the ability to, and maybe he's just going to not have any gas in his tank. That's fine. That's possible. But I also in this, you know, I got Sixto Sanchez who could maybe not even pitch, Denelson Lamet who was good and then not good. So, I mean, of that mix, I think Greinke stands out. I was able to get Jose Miranda. I think that's, I'm excited about the possibility there. I really wanted to get Josh Jung in a lot of these until he had that enormous setback. So I feel like Miranda's kind of it steps into that role a little bit. And I got Paul DeJong and with my last pick. And I think again, a shortstop that's going to play. I was pretty happy actually to be able to get him with pick 438. So overall, I think I did okay. Especially for my first go at a TGFBI draft with a really challenging group of guys, really sharp people that I was drafting with, top to bottom. And people that you would know, like Eno, Carlos Meccano, and even people that maybe people don't know, like me, I'm probably one of those people, but everybody was very purposeful in their choices. You could see they were executing plans and, even if it wasn't a strategy that I would have employed, you could see what they were doing and they were making it work. So, it was a wonderful experience. I'm not sure how it's all going to shake out, but, that's why we play the games, hopefully.
So a quick like thought for you here, whenever you go to like the My Team sort of like view, you know, you get those like Fantasy Pros grades and stuff like that. I don't personally put a ton of stock into those because they kind of just add up your totals, and like I preach against that. But it's always fun.
And they
to
also
see.
Assume that the team is going to be the same all year long. Yeah, I would actually think it applies more in the Raz Slam than it would.
I agree.
For TGFBI. I mean, I can tell you what mine says. My it's actually kind of silly. My TGFBI score came out as an A-, 92 was the overall grade. But I actually do have Fantasy Pros. This is not a plug. They didn't pay me to say this, but I do have Fantasy Pros. I think it's one of those things that's like on auto renew and it just happens in the darkness, and I haven't stopped it. And you know, listen, there's good resources there. There's a lot of really smart people that contribute to Fantasy Pros. So whatever, it is what it is. But when I go in, it actually tells me I got an A+ and a 99, and I'm projected. My projected league rank is 1 instead of 3. So, I mean, again, how much stock do you really put in these things? If it was like a put it on the board, kind of like set it in stone thing, we wouldn't need to actually have the matchups. I've had plenty of years where I've come out of the draft with a nice rank from whether it was RotoWire software or Fantasy Pro software and didn't finish anywhere near. And then there have been years where I came out as, you know, I was going to finish dead last and made the playoffs. So it's a long season. There's a lot of moves. The people on your team now are definitely not the same people that you're going to have all year long, which this thing kind of presupposes. But I do think it's more like a, did I blow it or did I do okay? And so I feel like I did okay. That's kind of my takeaway.
Yeah. Similar sorts of things when I scanned some of my other places. I mean, if you have some sort of like numerical foundation to base your draft picks on, and you don't just totally screw it by like having to like draft a bunch of guys that your numbers say are crap because you've made bad choices. Like, I'm not going to say Ahmed Rosario was a terrible pick. By my own markers, he was actually supposed to be better than ADP at that point. I just never have believed in him in my life. So he's the sort of guy that you've always been able to shift by playing him straight up, and he'll just hit it right up the middle and right at, you know, like the second baseman. Like, teams used to like play shifts where they'd just like go closer to the back. Like, it was weird. So he's the sort of guy where it's like, in this he looks good, my heart didn't love it, but then I'd put in other my heart loves it picks that probably don't show up great in these sorts of things. So like, if I'm like a 89 B+ in my TGFBI or whatever, I'm like, yeah, sure, great, thanks, I didn't totally screw up, but cool. And I don't worry about that stuff. It's fine.
Shout out to those who are making the projection systems, though, that do all this. That's a hard thing to do. I'll just say I tended towards the bad X for my offensive projections, and I tended towards ATC for my pitching projections, and did some more blending and my own stuff. But without all of that hard work from those people who are poring over those numbers, there's no basis for me to be able to go in and try and do that. So my gratitude to all of you out there grinding with projection systems. That's a tough thing to do. I appreciate the effort. We had talked about that for a lot longer than I thought we were going to. And I think that's fine. I think it's interesting for us to be able to kind of go through that. We've got maybe like 15, 20 minutes left. Let's move into just kind of talking about using these formats, these industry formats, do like a case study on industry expert leagues versus other like home league type stuff. And there's a whole bunch of stuff in our rundown here. So I'm going to do this. I'm going to go through the rundown and the options, and then I'm going to let you, again, choose your own adventure. That's going to become the theme. So I'm going to go through all of the options here. I'm going to let you choose where we start. And maybe, listeners, if there's something that I mentioned that we don't get to that you want us to talk about, you can email us, dugoutstudyhall@gmail.com. You can obviously get us on Twitter, either individually or at the pod. And let us know that you'd like us to talk about it. Real quick, real quick before we do this, I just want to acknowledge in the deep our friends at Pitcher List Pods, Schwebzy and Jordan White, who took us down in the first matchup, the first head-to-head matchup in the baseball pods tournament of podcasts.
It was
pretty close. But I can't imagine losing to a couple of nicer guys. I hope you guys do really, really well. Next year, though, we're coming for you. So here are the topics. Here are the topics that we can talk about. We could talk about the nuanced differences between things like TGFBI and Raz Slam that tend to be widely inclusive. And then in industry expert leagues like Labor and Tout that are more exclusive. And that's not a dig. It's not, I don't mean any negative connotation. It's just kind of the way that it is. We could talk about salary cap versus snake draft strategies that matter or don't. We can talk about leagues that are more best ball versus weekly lineups or daily lineups. We could talk about leagues that are more FOB versus draft and hold, where you still set a lineup every week, but you don't get to pick people up off of waivers. And we could talk about how all of these industry leagues versus high stakes leagues versus home leagues kind of settle out. We have talked a little bit about that before, but we could maybe dive a little bit more deeply into that. I'm going to let you choose your adventure, Mr. Chase. Where do you want to go?
So the thing that really kind of like made me think most over the past week and change was a combination of things that are all kind of anchored around like the salary cap style leagues. There was some really weird and funny discourse about, I think it was like a Labor salary cap team or like league where someone had like gone after a bunch of dudes with like injury risk and stuff like that. And there's,
just for clarity's sake, salary cap leagues, not something that is a brand new invention. If you haven't heard the term before, it's they're previously known as auction leagues, moving away from that term, just for clarity's sake, moving away from that term to salary cap leagues.
Yeah. And there was some weird hubbub about it, about like, you know, how you can't win if you're building a really like risky team. And I mean, it was very much a people talking about formats differences. And I think most people kind of like smoothed over it, but it really made me think about some stuff like that, like how much choice you get in that format. Then we saw a bunch more of them come in, and we saw a lot of people like Rates and Barrels talked about one, a bunch of other people talked about theirs. And one of the things that spun out of that is a tweet by Rudy Gamble about how there really isn't any option for psychological strategy in these sorts of games. I don't know if you're like, have you done a salary cap league recently enough to like have an experience?
I've never done a baseball one. It feels very overwhelming to me. I've done football. I think it's the best way to draft a football team. Yeah, but when you're drafting a football team, there's you can get it done in 4 hours, maybe 5 hours. Baseball feels like it would go on for all the live long days. But definitely something I'm not opposed to. I like that it's very different. You can be in on every player, but no, I have not done a baseball salary cap style league.
Yeah, so like, I'm sure you've done this in football then, where you'll like early on toss the names of like guys you don't want.
That'll cost a lot.
Yeah, to make other people have to get them. And, you know, Rudy's like, doesn't really matter. And one of the things he was talking about, though, is that his experience was, I think, based on doing it for Labor or Tout mostly. And he's a guy who like, is really competitive in Labor and Tout, especially in those sorts of formats, because he's a numbers guy for Razzball. And, you know, the more vibesy style people do tend to have an issue in some of those places, relatively speaking. And one of the things that got kind of like rung interestingly for me is like, I had very recently finished up like a startup salary cap draft for a dynasty league where that was not true at all. And you were definitely able to gauge the room a little bit. And I think that experience has really made me think about the ways the people at different positions, the ways people different sort of archetypes, and like, you know, just generally speaking, like the guys that get more recognition and who are more fun kind of tend to play out in those sorts of ways. And I thought it was really interesting to compare how I have to operate and think versus like
you know, just like strict hit the numbers guy, go for $25 next sort of thought. And yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting. So like, I'm curious then, like, you've been in one of these rooms before. You ever been in that situation where it's like everyone like overspent for like the first hour and like nobody has any money left?
It's interesting how things go. I think that it really does have to do with who gets called when. And it makes sense to me that in an expert industry league where people are uber prepared and uber knowledgeable, even if they're not super numbers people, they know baseball, they know the player pool, they're really good about kind of gauging values. I was listening to Nick kind of go through his process and how he had put values on play positions, not people. It was just very, very interesting, the approaches. So I can see not being able to gain an advantage there. Like if you're playing chess against chess masters, right? Like everybody kind of understands what you maybe are trying to do in a more friendly league. I do think that there are ways that you can kind of nominate with a purpose, where maybe early on you throw out like in football kickers, right? The adage is don't spend more than a dollar on a kicker. So, you know, maybe late when there's money left over, somebody goes, haha, I'm going to go $2 on that because I can. Whereas early on, nobody's going to want to take that extra dollar off their board because they don't know if that's going to be what they need to be able to get that $9 player in the middle of a draft. So I definitely think that there's like ebb and flow. What I disagree with is that you can kind of know ahead of time what that's going to be, because it's so vastly different depending upon a particular auction, a room. You know, if Tatis gets nominated early and goes for big money, that changes everything. And there's no way you can gauge that ahead of time. So I think that there are some human behavioral things that you can anticipate. I think that especially in a home league situation where maybe people aren't as with all of the details and the depth and everything, right? Because it's not what they do every single day. It's easier. But I don't think that you can go in and say, okay, I've created this algorithm that is going to predict human behavior, and then I can execute the draft that way. And maybe that's why for a numbers person, it feels like it's a useless endeavor to try and game the system, because the way to game it is less with a, like I said, like an algorithmic approach, and more like I have a sense, or I've got my eye on that board. So if you're a numbers person who kind of needs to have things set up ahead of time versus somebody who can recalculate on the fly, that's going to be a big difference too.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know. Did I answer your question at all?
I think you kind of did. In that, like, things get weird is kind of the point that I wanted to make. And
yeah,
one of the things that occurred to me seeing his comment, kind of like trying to figure out how well it matched some of my past experience, because I played a lot of different salary cap leagues over the years, and that's one of the things that actually got me to like try to start doing any of my own stuff, is like I had this bizarre salary cap league with a required DH spot, and no one even has that option for like the Fangraphs auction calculator and stuff like that. So what got me thinking though is like the vast majority of actual drafts like that happen are not populated by actual experts, and even those that are still get off the rails. And
sure.
So like the idea that, like, you know, you're playing against rational people, you know, like you can't really gain an advantage by, like I did, nominating Adalberto Mondesi early because I wanted someone to spend too much on him. Where's that room was kind of my thought. And what that kind of like brought out of me was like, I probably need to be thinking a little bit more about the ways that the things that I do or don't take into account the idea that people are going to be irrational. So like TGFBI, I didn't take Paul Goldschmidt, like I said, because I knew that I'd be able to get a first baseman that I valued quite a bit later on, because other people aren't going to be valuing people the same way as me. In this dynasty startup, I found that outfielders of basically any age, and first baseman of basically any age that don't steal bases all went for less than I would have predicted, relatively speaking. So like I got George Springer for a deal. I got Nick Castellanos for a deal. Basically every first baseman went for a deal other than like Matt Olson, who went like at price. Vladdy,
even went for relatively less than I thought he should have in this particular format. And like trying to reconcile, like, can I predict these things? I think there are a few cases around the edges where I think it isn't a fully futile sort of thing. I think we can kind of plan to say that, like, yeah, Jesse Winker probably will slip a little bit. And so you don't need to take someone in the 50 to 675 range if you can bank on him later. But like, that's what this sort of thing all kind of got me thinking on, is like, it's not that really those leagues require a different style of thinking, it's that they like kind of help to uncover how crazy we all are and just kind of ignore it because of snake drafts. And that was kind of a fun, it's like, oh yeah, duh, sort of experience.
Yeah. I mean, the salary cap approach, it seems like there are definitely trends, but you just don't know where the cliff is going to be or who the people are going to be. You know, when the room is flush at the beginning, you wind up with people going for value. But once the top, you know, let's say Tatis goes for, I don't know, what's a crazy number on a $260 budget? Is 50 a lot?
Let's say that like a Yahoo style, like 12 team league, I know that he should probably go for somewhere in the 40 to 45 range, but let's say he goes for 55.
Yeah, right. So he goes for 55. There's actually a chance that somebody's going to go for an even crazier amount because somebody wants a top two shortstop, right? So maybe they go for 56, or maybe they go for 51, which is still more than it's supposed to be, because everybody's kind of got that money and they like, I'm definitely getting one of these two guys to start off my team. There's also the situation where you get the bargain if you go for the superstar that's the first one off the board. The second one, because they're the last person in the tier, might actually go for more. Then there's like these lulls in the middle of those kinds of drafts where there's value. And then at the end, you wind up with all the people who didn't go in with these bankrolls who can come over the top of you and wind up driving the prices up on the $4, $5, $6 players and make them $7, $8, $9 players. But you're never going to know when that's going to happen or who that's going to happen with. And you don't, it's not like there's an ADP for salary cap, right? You can nominate in whatever order you want. And that's another wild card. It's just, there's too many variables to try and quantify and figure out. So I really like that about it, because it feels more human. And to your point, human is sometimes chaotic.
Yeah. So one of the things I did to try to like figure out what to do amidst all that, and this is truly insane behavior on my part, all told, because I'm the commish of this startup, so I need to like be there in case anything freaks out and like someone nominates the wrong person or like clicks the $15 bid instead of the $5 bid, which did happen. But all the while, I had a Google Sheet going where I would, compared to like my projected values for people, write down what they went for. So all the while, I was tracking how much had been spent, how much talent had been taken off the board, and then the difference between how much talent was remaining and how many dollars were remaining. I had like written some like things. So I just type in 9 besides Josh Bell or whatever, and it like automatically calculates it and it goes to a place, because like, this is what I do for fun. And I was able to find that within an hour or so, people had spent $200 more than the talent that had come off the board. And a lot of money had come off the board. And so what that meant was that an hour and a half in, there was significantly less money than talent remaining. And it persisted that way basically until the end of the draft. And I was able to get $5 to $10 discounts on 7-8 players. And that's how you win, essentially. It's just being able to keep track of that. Whereas on the other side of things, if you notice that you're in the opposite direction, that more people are holding money, you can track that. That people have been going for deals, you need to spend now in that sort of situation, because it's things are going to reverse. So yeah, it is possible to measure that and come up with a strategy that's reactive based on that, but like, you can't plan one way or another, and it's really labor intensive to do what I did. Like, I had to be paying absolute attention for like 4 hours straight on one night, and we only got halfway through the draft. For the 15 seconds that I turn my back away to pull up my phone charger, say a Suzuki win for $2, and I'm still upset about it. I have no idea how it happened. But yeah, that's what my experience was. That
what you're talking about there is an outlier way of doing things, right?
Right, like, right.
You can go into a snake draft with a sheet somebody else made and do okay.
Yeah.
You go into an auction, a salary cap situation, and there's not an ADP list there. You can create values and you could try and do that, but those values are not meant for your room. And to your point, as soon as that starts, those values are mere suggestions, because now you have either more or less money than talent available. Unless it goes like everybody goes for value, your prices are all out of whack.
One of the things I will say to that, though, is that the suggestion that Rudy had, that's like you can't game the room, is that you basically should have like a projection for everyone's, you know, like value. And like you can go within $2 or $3 of that. You know, it's like, for example, I paid more than my sheet said that I should pay for Aaron Nola because I had fed in ATC's stuff for Aaron Nola into my thing. And I had kind of artificially pushed pitcher prices down, but I knew that pitchers were going to be treated a little bit differently. And I was willing to pay up a couple dollars more for pitchers that I personally liked. Because I knew that if I was going to pay at or above value for a couple of them, I knew other positions where I was going to be able to get some real steals in. So like I treated pitchers a little bit differently, but everything else I kind of waited on. The thing is, though, if you just do that throughout, you don't overpay, but you like set a, I need to make sure I have three players in the top, whatever, and you're willing to pay at value for a couple of them. You consistently are bidding. You're not just waiting. That's how you don't end up in a situation where you spend all your money in the wrong places, is kind of like the theory, right? And it's tough to do that. I had to get really lucky that Shohei Ohtani went for way less than he should have to me, to make sure I had spent enough money early on. But otherwise, like, you can kind of game those sorts of things. I don't know that a ton of people actually play these things, relatively speaking. They are so hard to set up. Also, it's fine getting 14
That's what
people
I mean. Yeah.
To all block out the same evening to be able to be online is just
impossible.
So
yeah, well, the barriers to entry, I think, in accomplishing what you're saying is it's much higher when you're talking about salary cap than you are snake draft. The one thing you can do in salary cap, though, if you don't really know what you're doing, is just follow the leader a little bit. That's another way that you can do it. If that guy who's really smart is bidding, I just have to go one more dollar. How dumb am I if I paid an extra dollar? But it's also how you can get trapped into overpaying. If somebody catches on to the fact that you're doing that, they can bait you into spending more than you should.
Yeah, I'm typically willing to go a buck or more above for the real cornerstone guys. But once we get into a point where, like, for example, like I got a deal on Alex Bregman. I would not have gone a dollar over Alex Bregman's price. Like, I don't care about it that much.
Yeah.
And that's the big thing. So, yeah. I'm also shocked by the number of people who keep showing up on all of my teams. Then I'm like, am I crazy? Am I doing something wrong? And like, so like Tyler McGill has showed up on multiple of my teams now. And I'm like, what am I doing here?
Well,
I like
go
him.
Tyler. Yeah. All right. Well, Alexander, thanks again for another awesome episode. That does bring us to the end of this one. If you could just go ahead and let the people know where they could find us.
Well, they can find you on Twitter at @TheCorkedMatt. I'm on Twitter at @Chase_rate. And most importantly, you can find our podcast on Twitter at Dugout Study Hall, where you can send us some questions. Please be sure to subscribe to the Pitcherless podcast feed if you haven't done that already. Leave us a good review if you can be so kind. And if you're not already, please consider becoming a PL Plus member so that you can harass us on the PL Discord. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.